Blog Talk Radio.
Progressive News Network Extra with Brooke Hines. And I'm Brooke Hines, your host. It is Thursday, October 17, and today we are joined by Victor Tiffany, the author of Bernie or Bust, Pioneering Electoral Revolt. And later, we will have Isha Legal come on to talk about critical support with regard to foreign policy. But first, I wanted to welcome Victor back. And are you there?
I am. Thanks, Brooke. Nice to be here with you.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on. It occurred to me that we did a pre-debate talk, and now there's so much more to talk about, having with the debate behind us and so much more that's happened with the AOC endorsement and the squad endorsement. Essentially, there's been some question as to whether Rashida Tlaib was ready to endorse at the moment, but there's been that, and there's also been NBC News attributing some of Bernie's best debate moments to Elizabeth Warren. What's your post debate take? What are your thoughts? Where are you at?
Well, I have not necessarily concerns, but observations. I think Bernie did a pretty good job. Even CNN was forced, or at least one particular journalist, Todd Graham, was forced to give him an A in the highest grade in the debate. And he did serve himself better by cutting down on his arm waving and really just focusing better on what he said and who he said it to. And he had a very terrific shot at Joe Biden after Biden claimed that he was the only one on the stage who's gotten anything really big done, and Sanders shot back, yeah, you got the disastrous war in Iraq done, you got the bankruptcy bill, which hurting middle-class Americans all over this country, you got trade agreements like NAFTA and PNPR, which China done, which has cost us 4 million jobs. So he took a really good shot at Joe Biden, and maybe not as quite as sharply as I would have, not quite of a sharp elbow as I would have chosen, but he didn't go after Warren. Harris went after Warren in a way that I think is useful to consider her response, Warren's response. It's the same response she gave four times when people asked Warren about a middle class tax increase to pay for her Medicare for All bill. Four times she refused to say what Bernie says all along. Yes, there's going to be a middle-class tax increase, but the overall costs are going to go down because premiums will be gone and co-pays will be gone and all these other medical expenses will be gone. So overall costs will go down. But he says, yes, there will be a middle-class tax break. Warren won't say that. And then when Harris confronted her, Harris, you know, said that she called on Twitter to delete Donald Trump's Twitter account, and asked Warren to join her in that. Will you? Yes or no? And she asked her twice, and Warren refused to answer that question. This is very serious. She's running for president of the United States, and she strikes me as a coward. And this is not a characteristic you want from someone who's going to be the commander-in-chief. She just doesn't strike me as somebody who's particularly courageous. Tulsi Gabbard could loan Warren a third of her courage and still have more than anyone else on that stage. So it's not a gender thing. It's just that Warren doesn't like answering questions. She doesn't want to risk, you know, losing support because for telling the truth. So instead of telling the truth, she's not saying anything. In other words, she wants to replace a man who lies by being a president who won't tell the truth. Lies of omission, if you will. That's not very inspiring from my point of view. So that's my take on Warren. She was continued to demonstrate her lack of courage. I think Bernie did a pretty good job, as I quoted there, going after Biden. Biden is the establishment. He says he wants to return the soul of America. What he's really saying is he wants to return to neoliberalism, which is the disease that got us Trump in the first place. Trump is a symptom to this disease. So I think people are figuring this out. Biden's not going to have some sudden drop-off unless, you know, he has an aneurysm or something. But he is slowly losing votes and losing support, including from the establishment, including from the Washington Post and CNN and even MSNBC, because they just realize he's sunsetting, and he's not going to be a strong candidate against Trump. So they're starting to put their weight behind the other establishment candidate, which is Elizabeth Warren. And then they're constantly framing Warren much further to the left than she actually is. She's much more aligned, and she proved this in 2016. She's much more in alignment with Hillary Clinton than she is with Bernie Sanders. So I think we're moving toward a 3- or 4-person race, and I'm going to join with a lot of other pundits recommending that these second-tier candidates, with one exception, drop out. And that includes a candidate that I like. That includes Tulsi Gabbard. She's not perfect. Bernie Sanders isn't perfect, but she is our plan B, right? If Bernie Sanders were to drop out for any reason, we're going to seamlessly shift from Bernie the bus to Tulsi or trash the Democratic Party. Even though her Medicare for All plan is not really Medicare for All. And I can come back to that. That's more of a policy analysis than it is a debate analysis. But I do think it's time for all these second-tier candidates. I'm talking about Harris. I'm talking about Buttigieg and Booker and Castro and Klobuchar and O'Rourke and Steyer, of course. To drop out and make this a 4-person race. And the reason I didn't include Yang, the only reason I didn't include Yang, is because he is actually still slowly moving up in the polls. And I think it would not be fair, even though I'm not particularly supportive of Yang, it wouldn't be fair to say, you know, you should drop out, when in fact he's winning people over to his position. If he flattens out sometime between now and, I don't know, March of next year, I think he'll probably drop out. And I think he'll be a good possibility for vice president or a cabinet position, a cabinet post, because he's a very smart guy. He's got things to contribute beyond the his main policy position of universal basic income. Mm-hmm. So that would make it a 4-person race, and that would allow, you know, is very important, I think, to bring an end to this all too heated conflict between Gabbard supporters and Bernie supporters. They're actually on the same team, and you wouldn't know it sometimes looking at my Twitter feed. There's people, they're at each other's throat, and there aren't much. Really genuine crossover if, like we said, she's plan B for us. So if she were to win the nomination, we would do everything for her that we will do for Bernie in the general. So, you know, for us, it's not one or the other. It's either or. We're really indifferent, even though Tulsi's not a lifelong progressive the way Bernie is. Tulsi's not as far left in foreign policy as Bernie is, and she's not as wise as Bernie is, but I have to give her this, she is more courageous than Sanders, and that became evident when Julian Assange was arrested. I think we talked about this the other night. Bernie said nothing. Just said nothing about it. Didn't condemn that arrest, which is pretty shocking. Tulsi Gabbard was out in front condemning that arrest, regardless to how it reflected on her polling or whatnot. She did the right thing. This is an assault on the First Amendment, which is one of the reasons I don't particularly like Andrew Yang. He thinks Assange should be brought to trial, and I just think that's ridiculous. So the idea would be to get this down to a three-person race as soon as possible, two on the right side, which is Warren and Biden, and versus Bernie Sanders. And that's one thing we need to fight against, the media narrative that Warren is somehow closer to Bernie than she is to Biden. She's consulting with Hillary Clinton. So that should basically be everything anyone needs to know. She's not progressive. She never says she's progressive. And she's aligned herself in 2016 and continues to align herself with the neoliberal wing of the party.
But you were just talking about exactly what I was on about yesterday with Warren's campaign hiring lots of Hillary Clinton consultants, and that I was seeing the Hillary Clinton approach in Warren's, especially in Warren's debate performance, but also in the way that her surrogates are behaving. You know, there was the big Ashley Preston dust up earlier this week, where Ashley Preston, her new LGBT, she's a African-American trans woman, had gone out and attacked Bernie Sanders for not supporting LGBT issues since, she said, the 70s. And that created a firestorm because, of course, that's not true. And it's completely disingenuous, David Brock style manure. And so people were calling her out on it. And then in the midst of all of that going on, how did this happen? In the midst of all of that going on, she really steps in it, and then it really like went over the top. And now I'm blanking, so I'm having a technical difficulty in my head. But at any rate, it just smacks to me. It reeks to me of Hillary Clinton fuckery. So tell us your thoughts on that campaign approach and how you see that being translated into Warren's campaign.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, she is consulting with Hillary Clinton. The problem with all campaigns, and this isn't anything new, is that candidates and surrogates and supporters all lie. I don't want to say they all lie, but, you know, we might stretch the truth. We might get hyperbolic. We might exaggerate. We might tell lies of omission. I'll give you an example. I told a lie of omission in the first part of this about Warren. She said something that shocked me. To the left on foreign policy of Tulsi Gabbard. During the debates, Warren said something that made my ears pop out of my head, because it's something we advocate in our book, Bernie or Bust, Pioneers of Electoral Revolt. And you don't hear candidates running for president in the Democratic Party actually say this, ever. So I was very pleased. It's really a Green Party position, which is that the United States should pull out of the Middle East. I got to give her credit for that. And it sort of contradicts my argument earlier that she's a coward, and maybe she'll never say it again. Maybe it was a whim. Maybe she wasn't giving it much thought. But if she stands by that position, that's a pretty solid pro-peace position, that we, you know, the United States has caused far more problems in the Middle East than we've solved. And she's absolutely right about that, that we do need to get out of the Middle East. So my main point to go back is there's all kinds of distortions. And it's hard for people to understand what the actual truth is when you have so many people saying one thing, you have other people saying something else, and now we don't know who's coming in through the internet from other foreign countries. They could be Israelis, they could be Russians, they could be Saudis, all pretending to be Americans. There are still people who claim that Burn Your Bus was a Russian operation.
Mm-hmm.
I still see them. And it blows my mind. It's like, no, I am not the Russian. So it's going to be very difficult for people to really understand what's fact, what's not fact. And I have a pretty involved and complicated understanding of the word truth, because truth, a lot of people think, oh, there's only one truth, because they confuse outside reality, what's going on out there, the facts of the world, if you will, with truth, which is a human construct, our ability to frame that external reality into words. And when we do that, we use words and descriptions that are tinted. I'm going to use that word because it's sort of coloring. There's a red tint if you're a Republican. There's a blue tint if you're a Democrat. There's a green tint if you're a Green. And it's tinted by our biases. And sometimes it's shaped by our ignorance or our level of knowledge. And sometimes it's shaped by our upbringing. But so I have the school of thought in philosophy that there are multiple truths, because there are different perspectives on pretty much everything, certainly everything that's political. And that just complicates this whole argument of what is the truth out there. Is Bernie, has Bernie stood up for LGBTQ rights or not? What we have to do, what everyone needs to do when it's an issue that's important, whether it's gun control or gun safety laws or reproductive rights, whatever an issue that is, might be a litmus test for any voter, and you hear any candidate or hear about any candidate has a policy position that differs from you and that litmus test, you got to go out and make sure that that is in fact the case, that it's not just somebody lying or giving a tinted, biased perspective that might include a lie of omission.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not easy to understand the truth, and you can't just, or we, nobody should just run with the first data point. Aha! Bernie is, whatever. I'm trying to think of it. He's a gun nut, because Hillary Clinton said he was a gun nut. Or, Warren might say that he's lax on gun control or gun safety, which is ridiculous. But it's important that we all have to. It's not just a matter of, we're in social media. We're all sort of part of the media. When we retweet something, we're retweeting something that we agree with, but we assume is factually accurate. And maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should all be reporters. But it even goes deeper than that. Even if you're not retweeting something, even if you're not repeating something, even if you're just comprehending something that somebody said or somebody reported news, even if it's a reliable news source in your mind, maybe you think CNN is reliable. And they show you pictures of Bernie who looks beat red after his heart attack. Oh, my God, he doesn't look healthy. Well, that turned out to be a distortion of reality. They had side-by-side cameras there, and he looked perfectly fine in flesh tones. And the CNN had some sort of weird filter on their camera lens and colored his picture. So I don't know if how much you've addressed CNN in the past on this podcast, but they are not the most trusted name in news. They are not a reliable source. They tell lies of omission every bit as much as Fox News and almost as much as MSNBC. MSNBC is brainwashing people. I keep seeing it all the time. When somebody accuses Bernie Bush of being a Russian operation, I just fire back, stop watching MSNBC. It is rocking your brain. And I'm thinking primarily of Rachel Maddow. I mean, she's just been on this tear about Russia influence in the government for a couple of years, and then the Mueller report came out, and it turns out she was completely full of manure. So,
and we saw a lot of bad information, even from presidential candidates up on the stage. Amy Klobuchar was at one point was repeating some highly disputed information with regard to Ukraine and that plane that was shot down. There's a lot of information as with regards to the Philippines, the plane from the Philippines that was shot down, and it was supposedly the Russians that did it, and that's not been able to be proven. And anyway, there's just been a lot of, you know, funny business with that. And when I see those talking points uncritically reinforced by the candidates, it makes me wonder how, if they're operating in good faith. Because I have to imagine that senators, in the case of Amy Klobuchar, that senators have access to intelligence information and should have more and better intelligence than people doing, you know, citizen journalist kind of research, and maybe that makes it worse. Maybe they're, you know, the stuff that's being put in front of them is just as politicized as what you're hearing on CNN, but the Russia problem is real, and they're using it towards foreign policy ends, or it's being used towards foreign policy ends to stoke this economic war. I mean, essentially, it's an economic resource war. That we're picking with Russia, which doesn't seem very smart to me.
Well, starting a new Cold War doesn't make much sense to me, and it's one of the reasons why I think Tulsi has gotten favorable tweets, I guess, from Russian bots and from the Kremlin. I mean, why not? She's coming out against a Cold War. I think that's very smart of her, And then the New York Times turns that into, oh, she's a Kremlin asset. What? It's amazing. Caitlin Johnstone, we talked about her the other night. She had a great piece on this. Truth is a Kremlin asset. Facts are a Kremlin asset. She's mocking, of course, this whole narrative that anything that the establishment or anyone really doesn't want to agree with, like, Bernie or bust is a domestic American strategy. No, it's a Russian asset. You know what I'm saying? She's mocking this whole notion that blaming Russia or blaming the Kremlin is somehow legitimate. And it's absolutely, for the most part, not. Now, I want to just go back on something you said, because we have to be very careful about what we know and what we don't know regarding Russian influence in the last election. We know they ran some ads on Facebook. They were clumsy. They were, you know, I guess it was about $50,000 worth of ads before the election, and they were so clumsy they kept running ads after the election. And there was some money spent on Twitter, and there were Russian bots. We know they tried to do something, but I'm not convinced they were involved in the DNC hacking. I don't think it was a hack. I think it was a leak. But I think it's real possible that they were the ones who were fishing for Democrat email accounts all across the country. It wasn't just Podesta that was targeted by someone. And it was Podesta who someone on his someone in the Clinton campaign basically gave the wrong answer. Is this something we should trust? And somebody meant to say no, and they said yes, and they put the password in, and bam, access to all his emails, access to that speech that Hillary Clinton gave to Wall Street Bank. And that really did have an impact on the election. So it's possible, if those hackers were actually Russian, that Russians did have enough of an influence to sway the election. But again, I'm not convinced, for reasons that you alluded to, that what's coming from the intelligence services is the truth. I mean, I don't even know how they can claim that the DNC server was hacked by Russians, because they never got to look at the server, the FBI. The DNC wouldn't give the FBI. So how does the FBI know this? They're relying upon an anti-Russian data agency called Crowdsource.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole point we make here is we really don't know the extent to which Russians, they may have had influence, they may not. And certainly it's not a good thing. And I think, again, we talked about this the other night. So if Russia, you know, involvement in our elections, or is Israel or Saudi Arabia or any foreign company, given the networked nature of some of our electronic systems, you know, not the electronic machine, but the county servers that tabulate what's coming in from the polling areas, given the network nature of it, and that some smart hacker somewhere might be able to get into these servers, Congress is just passing laws that make not just the general election, but the primaries based on hand-countable paper ballots. So if there's any question, we can go back and do a hand count of these primaries primarily, because again, last time in 2016 on the Republican side, the exit polling and the actual results always came within the margin of error. On the Democratic side, they often came back way out of whack, way off from what they should have been, far enough off that the State Department, if it had happened in Venezuela or any number of foreign countries, the State Department would declare that election illegitimate. Of course, no one did that in the United States, because that would make this whole system open to being illegitimate. And almost nobody in the corporate mainstream media wants to open that door. I don't know if they think it's Pandora's box that's being opened or what, but they should have. There should have been deep investigation into this whole thing. And then, of course, there's the other form of election fraud, which, I wish I could remember his name, the investigative journalist who exposed Interstate Crosscheck.
Palace.
Who, you know, describing, I don't know if you've covered this before on your podcast, maybe your audience already knows this very well, but Republican secretaries of state using this database of registered voters from one state to another, crossing off any name that matches from one state to the next. Sometimes, even if the middle name doesn't match, if it's John Henry Brown and John James Brown, it gets crossed off, right? Because Brown sounds like it could be a black person, and blacks generally vote Democrat. So the Republicans are basically, it's an election fraud. It sounds like voter suppression, but on this scale, it's election fraud. And that alone might have been why Trump was elected. We don't really, there's so many different factors involved, conflicting factors, you know, the hack of whoever did it, of the Podesta email account was certainly influential. Interstate Crosscheck was influential. The whatever was happening during the Democratic primaries was influential, because it's very possible Bernie could have won that nomination had it been a truly open and fair and not rigged operation. But it was, and then with a lot of people either not voting or, you know, writing in Bernie Sanders, or, you know, I don't know if you caught my tweet today, that I met a waiter at lunch, my waiter, who I mentioned that I'm behind the Burn Your Bus from. He says, oh, you like Bernie Sanders? He says, yeah, I wrote in his name in the general election. I says, oh, you were Bernie Bust. He says, I've never heard of that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
Never heard of the strategy. It's just that Bernie is such a strong anti-establishment candidate. You know, people are longing for his agenda. It's not a cult of personality. It's his progressive agenda. We have been raked over by this corporate neoliberal political ideology for anywhere from four to seven decades here in the United States, depending on when you think that influence really started to have a impact. I see it goes back to the Carter administration, but it may go back even further than that. And it's basically this rotten arrangement of pro-corporate, pro-market priorities. You can see it in a lot of different things, like privatization, right? You have a public service like water. Water should be supplied by the government, and people pay a tax to pay for this water supply, clean, potable water supply that comes out of our taps. Corporations are taking that over for profit. And that's, you know, schools, public schools are being shifted over to charter schools. When you have a candidate such as Elizabeth Warren, who has supported charter schools in the past, you're dealing with somebody who has neoliberal tendencies. So that's just, again, another example. I think the so-called free trade agreements, which are not our grandfather's free trade. These things are not about low tariffs. That's what free trade used to be, low tariffs and prohibition against currency manipulation by governments. That's all free trade should be. That's all it used to be. But now they're using that label as a Trojan horse to impose on not just our system of government, but in the case of NAFTA, three different countries' systems of government. And NAFTA was just a warm-up for what they were attempting to do with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I have to stress, this was happening before Donald Trump came along. Donald Trump was a reaction. People said, I'm not getting behind more of this neoliberal. They saw Hillary Clinton was going to, even though she said she opposed, she first, as Secretary of State, called the Trans-Pacific Partnership the gold standard of free trade, which is a very frightening thing given everything that's in that so-called free trade agreement. And then when Bernie came out against it, she said, oh, well, I'm against it now, and, you know, we have to fix a couple things here and there. She didn't mind the fact that corporations were writing their own rules, you know, transforming our system of self-government to corporate self-government. That didn't bother her, but there were a couple other things that did. And they knew that if she was elected, this thing would sooner or later become the law of the land, and people were going to start losing their jobs being outsourced to Vietnam or, you know, New Zealand or wherever else these corporations wanted to set up shop overseas. And it would continue to harm American workers. So what's happened in the last election is the working class has shifted over to the Republican Party. And if the Democrats want them back, that is to say, if the Democrats want to win next year, they're going to have to go with the candidate who's going to get those working class Americans back. I mean, they feel betrayed. They feel betrayed by Donald Trump, and they're not going to come back to a Joe Biden or an Elizabeth Warren. But they will vote for Bernie Sanders.
I feel like there's
– for his agenda.
Right, and I feel like there's a reason why people have moved to Bernie Sanders that kind of transcends progressive politics and transcends just, you know, the way that campaigns are, you know talk about campaigns, and what I'm talking about is people want a circuit breaker. And I think people thought that Trump was going to be a circuit breaker, that there is there's a lot of skepticism about whether or not Washington in toto serves the interests of the people or just serves the interests of donors. You know, people aren't stupid. They can see what's happening. And business as usual, candidates and campaigns isn't cutting it. So business as usual campaigns have stepped up their offense with, Russia's coming to get us, and that Russia's an existential threat, and you have to vote for us because Russia. Well, they're doing that because it's really the last refuge of scoundrels at this point. It the only way to get people, and what they're admitting, I think, in doing this is that the only way to get people to vote for them, the Democratic Party, is to ratchet up the rhetoric so. You know, so much that what we're talking about is an ultimate battle between the United States and what I think these people think is the Soviet Union, because it, over and over again, I see people in corporate media referring to Russia as if it's still Soviet Union, pre-1989 kind of stuff. Joy Reid especially is terrible with this, and has confused the two a lot. I want to bring in Isha Krishna Swami, who is calling in, and she has some thoughts on it. Is the perfect segue to bring Isha in, because she has some thoughts on foreign policy and how important it is to maintain this swagger of critical support for Bernie with regard to foreign policy, and not just kind of lose our minds and accept everything that comes along. So, Isha, are you there?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, excellent. Actually, I'm glad you brought up Russia, because in May, I actually went to Russia. And what I realized is that everything you hear in the US news media is about Russia is basically a lie. So a lot of us seem to... So right now, there's a lot of protests going around the world. There's a protest in Venezuela, there's a protest in Hong Kong, there's a protest in Ecuador. And so what you should notice is that the U.S. media is very selective about which protests they cover and how there's a unilateral consensus. For some odd reason, China is bad, Hong Kong protests are good. Even though Ted Cruz is in Hong Kong currently supporting the Hong Kong protesters, which makes me want to think. And then last week I saw many leftists, even people who allegedly call themselves Marxists, just blindly support the idea that the U.S. is needed to have a no-fly zone in northern Syria to prevent genocide. I don't want to do guilt by association, but when both Lindsey Graham and Benjamin Netanyahu agree with you, I think that is the moment where you need to stop and have some introspection. So I'm not seeing enough. So basically, if they've been lying to you about national security issues, about how Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, they lied to you about Syria, they lied to you about Libya, why are you guys time and time again believing all their crap?
And I've seen this over and over again, just in the last year. There's the people swallowing the line on Venezuela, and Bernie was trying hard to thread that needle, and for my taste, could have thread it better. He's had trouble threading the needle with regard to Julian Assange. Actually, that's not threading the needle. He's not addressed Julian Assange yet.
He did. Yeah, I held off all donations to him until he finally came out and denounced that arrest. But he didn't do it until after Rachel Maddow did. He was sort of waited for, I guess, a gatekeeper at MSDNC to raise a stink about it, and then he finally denounced that arrest weeks after.
I need to dig that up because the Action for Assange group has been asking about that, and you know, did a thing where they kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, ambushed him at the end of an event, and I think this was right before his heart attack too. And you know, when you're in a mass of people and someone is putting a microphone in your face or a little recorder and saying, what do you think of Julian Assange? And he's just moving through the handshake line. It wasn't a good moment for either. You know, it wasn't a good moment for Bernie. It wasn't a good moment for the citizen journalist. Go ahead, Isha.
Oh, okay. I'm just saying, more than just Assange, Assange is very important, and he is a dissident who's being silenced because he's exposing war crimes. We need to not let let me just go through what I go through whenever I see something on U.S. news. So let's say that let me give you some examples from the past of real democracy initiatives. Like, it happened in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, but none of you heard of it because the U.S. media, if it's an organic protest movement, just does a blackout of it. What you did hear is the fake one in Libya and Syria that was mostly made from like extremists. So for me, I would rather, instead of like talking about individual cases, I want to kind of give people the, like, obviously most people won't be able to, haven't traveled as much and aren't as hyper aware to the national security BS. So how do we give people some tools to be able to figure out, wait a minute, is this a place where I don't know enough? Should I believe this narrative? Should I investigate? Who should I go to when I want to investigate? What do I ask? Like, that, I'd rather people have the tools to be able to do this in the future on their own.
Yeah, well, and I think that the better equipped we are with regard to our journalist toolbox or our critical thinking toolbox, we're bringing better questions to the table and consuming what's going on in these campaigns in a more reasonable way. So there are, like, my preference would be for Bernie to come out and say, you know, 100% don't mess with Maduro. They're a sovereign country.
And he's more democratically elected than our dictator, who only won, 36% of the votes. Maduro won 60% of the entire voting population.
Wow. I didn't know that comparison. That's pretty damning. And they just did a constitution that they all voted on, which we haven't done for quite some time. And few people would be able to, you know, tell you pretty much what's in the constitution, it seems to me at this point. But I'm sorry, continue. I think I interrupted.
I guess I want to get this bigger than Bernie because it's going to be, like, the case for Bernie is obvious. If you care about anyone brown, you should definitely vote for Bernie. Otherwise, you're being dishonest. I mean, Elizabeth Warren swallows up every dumb national security narrative. She called him President Guaido. So I want to kind of be like, so Americans, now that, like, time and time again, you've been shown that your government and your media frequently lies with the national security, like, how do you stop yourself from acting, getting manipulated? Like, you know that, like, for example, I've had an unreasonable number of leftists argue with me that the Rojave movement is a true leftist movement that somehow is being funded by the CIA. Come on. I think this should be what we should, like, I guess we need to both, and people, we need to stop fearing about whether or not mainstream media is going to call us communists, just to say that you're a Maoist and you want to, like, whatever, just ignore that and be immune to that and learn how to, like, be brave. But more than that, it's like once Bernie is president, like, we're not going to be immune to mainstream regime change narratives. So what – okay, so how can we tell between something that we should be really weary of versus something that's probably legit?
And how do you tell?
For me, the first thing is if I hear it on the U.S. media being covered positively, red flags go up, and then I start to investigate. If I hear nothing but silence, then I think it's probably legit. But if the minute they start saying freedom, democracy for some other country that is an enemy of the U.S., like, or whatever, for me, I just stop, like, at that point. And so I stay silent until, for the most part, I stay completely silent until I know enough to be confident that it's not a U.S.-backed coup or whatever, attempt or whatever, and also not be swayed by any calls to denounce anyone. We have enough dirt on our hand. Our hands are very filthy, so we shouldn't be denouncing anyone else for human rights violations or whatever. Then I would also check to see where the other, like, how the other international media is covering it. Like, if Saudi Arabia is covering it, if Saudi Arabia, the peninsula, or whatever, the Gulf is covering it positively, but Iran is covering it negatively, you have to pause for a second. And also do not, like, expatriates have left the country for a reason. Do not just blindly trust expatriates. They're not welcome in their country, and often it's for very good reason.
That's a very good point. And where you live with regard to the expatriates who are in your community is going to make a big difference. So, like, my handle on Twitter is Nashville Brook, and I spent 10 years in Nashville, where a lot of the expatriates are there because of the Southern Baptists have brought them over with missions and stuff. And there's a lot of funny business that happens in mission work.
Oh yeah,
it gets caught up in
Uganda.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, I do want to bring this back into the Bernie thing, because, you know, of all of the candidates and all of the rhetoric that we're hearing now, Bernie is the only one who I believe comes from a place, comes from the same critical place that we're coming from. And sometimes I see him try to thread a needle and you know, say things that aren't too far outside of the box so that he doesn't become a target. But I always hear him having the same kind of affinities that we do, even if we don't hear the full-throated support that we would like to hear on certain issues. But I think that as a foreign policy president, he would be amazing.
Actually, Bernie is a great example. Notice how the media, like, Bernie is offering the mildest reforms on the international scale. And notice how the media is hyperventilating about Bernie and how he's going to bring up, I don't know, whatever crap they are thinking of. Now, imagine somebody like Maduro, who's nationalizing all the oils, who's giving everyone in Venezuela, like, they have, like, a really massive housing project, and they're basically nationalized a lot of lands taken up by U.S. oil companies. Like, how much do you think they're lying about him?
Well, I want to just talk about Sanders and his reference in the previous debate toward Maduro, who called him a vicious tyrant, I think is the phrase he used to describe Maduro.
Dear God.
That wasn't the truth. I mean,
he
allows his he's trying to overthrow his government to go around the streets organizing. Yes. A vicious tyrant would never do anything
Imagine.
Like that.
Oh, no. This is worse than that. Let me guys tell you what the opposition has done so far. Okay. So basically about 3 years ago, it was organized by Leopoldo Lopez. But basically, they took a helicopter and bombed the Supreme Court. What would happen to you if you bombed the Supreme Court in America?
That's insane. We would be losing our minds.
No. But would the person? Okay, Maduro has they got 4 years in prison or something, and a lot of them are being released after they bombed the Supreme Court. That is, by definition, not a tyrant. He's letting, you know what I mean?
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And he let Guaido back into the country. And, you know, he did a lot of stuff.
He gave mass amnesty to all the people. There have been multiple coup attempts. So, from the 2005 coup attempt, he gave mass amnesty about 2 years ago as a way of healing. So literally the opposite of a tyrant. But the U.S., according to the U.S., basically anyone who won't let U.S. oil companies hang profit is a tyrant, and anyone who will is an awesome man. So you have to understand what their definition of freedom is the ability to exploit.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, come on, Victor, what's your response?
I just want to just take a step back to a little bit earlier in the conversation about how do you know, where do you get reliable information? And it's one of the sections of our book on page 276. I refer to revolutionary media and people we generally can rely on to tell the truth. And in foreign policy, I don't think there's a more reliable, truthful, brave voice out there than Abby Martin of the Empire Files.
Absolutely. Well, now she has a new day. Also, another thing is that with the foreign policy, all these leftist independent quote-unquote media, they're the first to fall. Cenk Uygur and the Young Turks. Yesterday, Anna made a weirdest comment about how the U.S. is protected, is not there for regime change in Syria. So, unfortunately, your favorite independent news station that's not corporately funded is going to let you down too on foreign policy. So you yourself will have to have a super critical eye and look for the signs. And agreeing with Lindsey Graham is definitely a red flag, no matter what. I think a lot of the independent news medias are looking for legitimacy, don't want to be seen as too nutty by saying something like Gaddafi's Democrat, the most democratic person, Gaddafi's Libya was a direct democracy or something. Then they're afraid that they will get marginalized. So that pressure keeps them from saying untrue things. That goes against foreign policy in order to seem sane, which to me seems wild.
So, Victor, I want to go back to what you were just talking about too in the chapter in your book. So, was I hearing that correctly? That you've got some ideas in the book about good sources and ways to work critically through these issues?
Yeah, another one I strongly trust is Chris Hedges. Truth is, he's a former New York Times reporter, and spent years overseas.
But
you don't like Chris?
Not Chris. I don't think we need to be. We shouldn't be talking about people because people are infallible. You have trusted sources. I have so far trusted Chris on almost everything. But there was a time when Ed Schultz came out against bombing Libya. So I'm just saying, like, we should rather give them methodology instead of, like, telling who. Like, we should be giving them the tools to figure it out themselves as opposed to just telling them, read Abby, read Chris Hedges. Like, they need more skills than just people to follow.
Yeah, I think the one of the things that you can learn from Hedges and Abby and really good reporters, Max Blumenthal comes to mind, Aaron Matei, Dan Cohen, Ben Norton. Oh my God, I always forget Ben Norton. I need to etch that into my brain. What I learned from those guys, and I do this too, I say, you know, check out these people instead of looking at the methodology, because I feel like if you're paying attention to really good journalists, you're getting the methodology. They're telling you, Abby does a really good job of this, of saying, this is what we did. We went to this place and we interacted with these people with the hopes of getting this story, and this is how it went. So she kind of gives you like the lay of the land, you know, so you can make up your own mind.
She did a fantastic job when she tried to look at Maduro's press, like the alleged press censorship in Venezuela. Like, she showed us that methodology. Like, yes, don't let like people who think, like CNN will never show you the methodology at all. They'll just say fact.
Right. And so you bring up a really good point that it's methodology that we need to be doing, and at the same time, there's this shorthand that Victor brings up about is that a total brain fart? I'm looking at Blog Talk Radio Studio again, but the shorthand that Victor talks about, I think, is super useful too, because people are kind of on a journey, you know, and we got to kind of start them in a place where they can see what's going on, and then they can, once they learn the tune, then they can, you know, play the song themselves, and that's when they're getting the methodology. If I can be so loose with a metaphor.
If I could just interject real quick, let me just say, if there's anyone out there writing both on foreign policy and methodology, it's Caitlin Johnstone. Reading her work gives methodology of skepticism and critical thinking that I don't think any of the rest of these reporters do. She's, in fact, more methodology than she is storytelling.
Actually, you're right. I was trying to figure out who Caitlin, she slipped my mind. It took me a minute. But, and to me, this weekend with, like, despite an alarming number of so-called progressive leftists, even people who call themselves Marxist reporters and personalities came out and, like, in favor of the U.S. staying in Syria. So, so it's like, so that's what's gotten me like very disheartened, because and same with Hong Kong, like an alarming number of progressive people are coming out in favor of the Hong Kong protests when their demands are completely unreasonable, and they are being like they said, Trump, come and save us, like under like. And you've seen what the U.S. does to every other country it invades. Like, what kind of – who would want the U.S. to invade their country as a way of liberty? Like, no sane person. So so that's what's gotten me alarmed is there – it's not people who are marginally informed who have a job, but people who do this for a living. Like, major progressive voices, major progressive news sources who are basically – pushing really bad regime change narratives.
So, guys, I think we are going over tonight. I have had some technical difficulties, Isha, before you came on, and so we restarted. We're in record mode now, I believe. And so, what I'm going to do is take this and make a pod and re-upload it really quick. it looks like what happened is Blog Talk Radio hiccuped while I was doing some editing in the studio before the show. And that sometimes happens. I super apologize for the inconvenience, but I think that this was a fantastic, very inspirational kind of discussion, you know, to have some different viewpoints and to really get this Bernie or bust, to really underscore and really kind of hop on that idea. And then, you know, we kind of pivoted and talked about methodology and good ways of being good critical researchers and stuff. And I just think if I could get this information into people's heads, like if I could just broadcast it and it just be there, like that'd be like, you know, like one of my three wishes if I had a genie. Like everybody understands critical skills go.
You know, with the Bernie or bust, it's so hypocritical because we all know half of those establishment people won't support Bernie if he's the nominee. And we shouldn't even be answering that question. We should tell them, well, make sure that Bernie is the nominee and this will become a moot point. I just don't want to answer that question ever.
That is such a good point.
That's one of our selling points. We describe this as a problem that we're presenting the Democrats with. And if they want to solve this problem, they just unite behind Bernie. And then, you know, the plutocrats will back Trump, but we will get the Bernie or busters and the Bernie or Trumpers and the working class people who won't come out and vote for a Warren or a Biden, and it really represents by far the best shot the Democrats are going to have to defeating any incumbent president with the economic winds at his or her back. It's just the way things are. So,
but do the Democrats want to win, or are they really vote blue no matter who? Do they want to win? And that's where it always comes back to.
You can bet that the one percenters in the party, the plutocrats, will be backing, if Bernie somehow comes out of this as the nominee, they will be backing Trump because they prefer Trump. Even members of the DNC, some of them, will back Trump over Bernie Sanders because as much as they dislike Trump, they really don't want Bernie breaking up the media monopolies and other things that they're very, very comfortable with. So he's a disruption. And I just want to really quickly point out to listeners that Caitlin Johnstone has her own blog. I think you can just find it searching Caitlin Johnstone, and she's on WordPress. So I've subscribed to that. It's just very, very good stuff. I can't recommend her highly enough. She combines methodology, mostly methodology, with some reporting, but her last post I see here is, "Truth is a Kremlin talking point." I just love her approach.
Yes. Oh my God! Oh my God! Wait, this is hilarious. Exactly. They love blitz. Okay, just so you get, like, I was just doing some research on Syria for my blog, which I can plug later. But I just noticed something. For the very first quote-unquote anti-Assad protest, some quote-unquote expatriates, i.e. people in Washington, tried to set up a fake Facebook event, but then like two people showed up. And so it kind of, like, they're telling on themselves. Like, when they say like Putin influenced the election with random memes, of course he didn't. And if like memes can overthrow our democracy, we have much bigger problem. But it's a very interesting look into how the U.S. Tries to all the experiments it does to destabilize other countries, because often these things that they accuse Putin of, like, they've done it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So, you guys, why don't you give your contact information out and let people know how they can contact you. Isha, you mentioned your podcast. So why don't you go first?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Historically.substack.com. And on Twitter, it's historic_ly. I do a lot of like old records, so you can kind of see like what the CIA did, whatnot. So hopefully I do enough that, but point taken, I will talk more about methodology from now on.
Cool. And Victor, what is the best way for people to get a hold of you and to follow you and also get the book?
Yeah, on Twitter, it's at Bernie or Bus. I know that's surprising, but the book is available at BernieOrBus.info, I-N-F-O. And if you want to reach out to me without using Twitter, if you don't use Twitter or whatever, on Facebook, I am the page owner for Revolt Against Plutocracy, which is the organization behind the Burn Your Bus strategy. So you can leave me a message there.
Okay. Super, super. Thank you guys so much for coming on tonight. I totally apologize for the technical issues. It is, one of the things that we deal with Blog Talk Radio from time to time. I am hoping to launch something, launch from here to YouTube. So I want us to all keep in touch and keep these discussions going as we start expanding our platforms to other places too. Bigger audiences, all that good stuff. So thank you guys. And I will be talking to you all real soon. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for letting me come on so quickly. Have a great day, everyone.
All right. So there you have it. This is a conversation that we're going to keep going with. I mean, this is, you know.
Oh, and just a sneak peek. I am going to have three pieces coming out, two in fair and one I don't know, about rent control and about comparison between Elizabeth Warren's climate plan and Bernie's climate plan. So just keep fairer.org. And I do a lot of media criticism there. So just go to fair.org and it's coming out sometime in the next 2 weeks.
Fantastic.
We can add that to our neoliberals page on our website.
Say again?
We're making a list. We can add that to our neoliberals page on our website. We're basically building a web page of opposition research.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Look at both of my pieces. But anyways, thank you so much, Brooke. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you, Victor. All right. What a great show. I've edited out the technical difficulties. And, I just want to leave you with this thought. We're in a struggle together, which means that we're never alone, which is kind of cool when you think about it. Join us again on Sunday for the regular Progressive News Network show with Rick Spezak and many guests this week and much more to talk about. For now, I'm Brooke Hines, and this has been Extra.